We're holding one line from the bottom in Megillah Chaf Zayin Amud Aleph. We discussed the idea of the responsibility of guests to partake in the taxes of tzedakah. And now the Gemara continues, Rav Huna, Gazal Tanita, he declared a day of fasting. So Rav Chana bar Chanilai and all the people who lived in his town, they came up there. Ramu alayu tzedakah. Now that they visited on a fast day, we saw in the Gemara in Brachos last night, Daf Vav Amud Beis, that the whole merit of a fast day, the big merits of the fast day is the tzedakah you give on that day. So when they declared a fast day, they collected tzedakah, they taxed everyone, now everyone gives tzedakah. So Rav Chana bar Chanilai and all his city who came along to partake of the fast, they suddenly they're being taxed by Rav Huna's town. V'yavu. So if the rabbi says pay, they pay. They have to pay from the taxes, they pay. Kibau lemeite, when came time to leave, to go, amu le nutvalan ma v'nezul v'nefonesba anye matin. They said, Rabbi, Mar, you see they call him Rabbi. Whenever you see the reference is Mar, it's a reference that students are talking. They said, Rabbi, give us back our tzedakah money, the way we learned the halacha last time. If a public came to a different town and they were taxed, they could say, give us back our tzedakah money and we'll use it to support the poor of our own town. So now Rav Chana bar Chanilai and his band, his group, his town, when they're leaving, they go to Rav Huna and they say, Rabbi, give us back our tzedakah money. We had to partake, we had to pay initially so people wouldn't think we're just skimping out on paying tzedakah. But we don't have to support your poor, we have to support the poor back in our hometown. Give us back the money and we'll support our poor. Amar lehu, so he said back to them, Tanina, we have the following braisa, b'amet v'rin amurim. When do we say that you take back the money to give your own pork, she'en b'she'en sham chaverir, when you don't have a chief rabbi there who's dealing with the public funds? You come to a city, they lay a tax to partake of the tzedakah fund, so you're a good Jew, you and your group, you partake of the tzedakah fund, but when you leave, you could say, hey guys, give me back my tzedakah money, I'll give it to my poor. So that's only so if there isn't a chief rabbi there, a chaverir. Chaverir is the guy who's a Talmud Chacham, who's responsible for everything the city needs. Avayesham chaverir, tinaten lechaverir. But in a city where you have this chief rabbi, you leave the money by him. V'kol sheken daniyei didiv ditchu alai smichei. And he said, and I'll tell you what, even more so in our case, because why did they come to partake of the fast day? Obviously, they were neighboring towns. He said to them, when your poor need money, who do they turn to? They turn to me. So if I'm feeding your poor, if I'm your chief rabbi to dish out the money, then when I collect the taxes, you guys should pay also. You can't say, let us go back to our village and we'll use it for our anim. When your anim need money, they come to me too. All the anim, my town, your town, everyone comes to me. So if I'm the one responsible for everyone, then when you guys paid your tzedakah funds to me, leave it by me. Okay, so we see here an interesting svara. Now, we have to wonder, whenever we read a line like this in the Gemara, was there really a need for this kol shekein? The Gemara sometimes says, Yehuda ve'od likra. There's a Gemara that says a concept. It quotes a pasuk to back this concept. And then it says, and in Judean territory there was a custom this way. So the Gemara says, what do you mean? You have a verse that indicates this halacha. You have to tell me, and not only is there a verse, you know, there's also, in Judean territory, there's this custom. What do you have to add that for? You already proved your point from the verse. And that became a prototype claim in the Talmud that's called Yehuda ve'od likra. Why do you bring the second proof? The first one was a powerhouse proof. There's a joke Rav Monk in Tells likes to tell. He'd sit in front of a class of 10th graders and he'd say, how could a tzaddik like Moshe Rabbeinu have a son who's a rasha like Korach? How could it be? And one kid would raise his hand and he'd say, but Korach wasn't Moshe's son. So Rav Monk would say, no, that's a good answer. And who knows another answer? You know, sometimes you have a good answer. You don't need a second answer. What does that mean? So over here too, if the first answer was such a good answer, Why did we need the Kol Shekein? You know, if the Gemara had a powerhouse answer, what do you need the Kol Shekein for? And this should automatically light up on our radar screen, and we have to ask ourselves, is the halacha like the first answer? Are we really going to say that wherever you have a chaver ear, he collects the funds? There are two questions on that. Question number one is what we just said. Why does the Gemara have to continue and say, and Kol Shekein, I'll prove it to you. What do you need the Kol Shekein for if it's such a good, strong, valid halacha? And question number two is, why didn't they know that? How come they asked for their money back? If the halacha is so obviously like this quote, so then why did they ask for their money back? So the halacha is more or less like this quote. But I just want us to become accustomed to asking, well, why did the Gemara have to bring a second point? Why did the Gemara have to say Kol Shekein? That should bother us. Back to the Mishnah. Rav Zayin Amad Beis, top of the page. En mochinet shel rabim leyachid, mipnei shemoridin oto mikdushato, divrei Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir says, you do not sell an item, a holy item that was used by the public to an individual. You don't sell a public shul to an individual shul. You don't sell a public Sefer Torah to an individual Sefer Torah, because you are diminishing in its holiness. Amru lo, they said to him, Im ken af lo miyuk dola liyuk tana. If that were the line of reasoning, then you wouldn't sell it from a big city to a small city. Okay, introduction. We are accustomed to the concept of lechatchila and bidieved vis-a-vis ourselves. I can perform a mitzvah in a lechatchila fashion. I can perform a mitzvah in a bidieved fashion. We have to know that the concept not only exists vis-a-vis ourselves, it also exists vis-a-vis the mitzvah. How so? Let's say we have a person named Joe Schmo. Joe Schmo harvested all his crops. Now Joe Schmo is very proud of his crops, and he wants to come and take off his truma and meiser, the biblical mitzvos of taking off the portion for the kohen and the tithe. So far, Joe Schmo is a fine Jew. Yes? Joe Schmo has one problem. He's deaf. He could talk, but he can't hear. Now, if Joe Schmo comes to take off his truma and meiser, he will do it and make the blessing where he can't hear the blessing. Bidieved, he fulfilled the mitzvah. Lechatchila, he did not fulfill the rabbinic aspect of the mitzvah of making a blessing prior to removing the truma and meiser. Right? What would we say? Well, he can't do any better. It's his mitzvah. God made him deaf. He can't do the mitzvah any better. Says the Mishnah in Truma. No, we tell Joe Schmo, go give someone else the responsibility to take off Truma and Meiser. I know it's your grain. I know it's your mitzvah. But we don't only look at you. We look at the mitzvah. And we say, can this mitzvah be performed in a better fashion? If it can be performed in a better fashion, lechatchila, do so. And so Joe Schmo, even though bidieved, if he takes off the Truma and Meiser, it's kosher. You know, it's not me'akev. If you didn't hear the blessing, it's a kosher blessing, bidieved, but it's not the ideal way to perform the mitzvah. And so from this Mishnah, we learn a concept which applies in many other areas of halacha, that we look not only at the individual performing the mitzvah, but also at the mitzvah itself and how it is going to be performed. You guys with me? Okay. That's point number one. Point number two. Whenever we learn Mishnayos, we have to know that the Mishnayos are case-driven. That we know, right? They want to get as much information packed into the Mishnah as they could. So the Mishnayos were case-driven. They looked for a far-out case, a case that could happen, not necessarily the most probable case, but a case that could happen. And they said, let's analyze that case. So we'll take a case which will teach us as many halachas as we can. So it's going to be slightly convoluted. So far, so good? Okay. Our assumption is that all opinions in the Mishnah agree on the weights in the Mishnah. What is more stringent? What is more lenient? The argument is, where do you draw the line? When does it become mutar? When is it asr? But everyone agrees that case number one is more lenient than case number two, and case number two is more lenient than case number three. The machlokas is, do you draw the line between mutar and asr, between case number one and case number two, or case number two and case number three? Did you guys follow that, or should I give an example? Is that clear? So far, clear. Okay. Let's take a Mishnah in Yoma. The Mishnah in Yoma says, Rabbi Yehuda is of the opinion that the Kohen Gadol was appointed a spare wife in case his wife would die, and that would disqualify him from bringing, from doing the Yom Kippur sacrifices. So they arranged it that he had a spare wife, just in case. So far, so good. The rabbis tell him, if you're worried about that, so you got to make a spare for a spare, and then there's no end to how much you have to be worried. Wait a second. Permutations, combinations, what's going on here? Probability of wife number one dying is, let's say, 1 in 30, 1 in 80, 1 in 1,000. I don't know. I don't know how old his wife was that year, right? If he's 80 years old and she's 93, I don't know. I don't know what their lifespan was in those days. Permutation of the second wife, who's 12, of her dying, I don't know. It's far less likely that two are going to die. What are the rabbis telling Rabbi Yehuda? If you're going to prepare a second wife, you got to prepare a third. And then there's no limit, then a fourth and a fifth. What are they saying? They're saying there's a limit to how worried you have to be. And once you cross that limit, so then there's no limit. You've gone beyond the limit. If you're going to worry about her dying, she's alive and well and everything's good, you're worried out of the clear blue sky, come Yom Kippur morning, she's dead. Well, okay, if you're going to worry about things that are so far-fetched, then you should know you've crossed the limit and then there is no limit. The rabbis also understood that it's less likely that two wives will die than one, and three than two. That's, everyone knows that. That wasn't their point. Their point was you're crossing a certain limit. Now let's read our Mishnah. Rabbi Meir says, you don't sell a public Sefer Torah to be an individual Sefer Torah because you are diminishing in its holiness. They said to him, if so, then you couldn't sell it from a big city to a small city. What do you mean? What's the comparison? A Beit Knesset, it doesn't say what it is. It says you don't sell something from public to individual. Let's say it's a Beit Knesset. Fine. It's talking about a Beit Knesset. But fine, let's say it's a Beit Knesset. So they told him, if so, you couldn't sell it from a big city to a small city. There's a difference between selling it from public to individual and selling from big city to small city. What are they telling him? Now we know. What are they telling him? Mr. Hassan, help us out. What are they telling him? Let's apply the logic of the Mishnah in Yoma. What are they saying?
It's going too far.
Right. Once you've crossed a certain border, so then what's the difference between this and a big city and a small city? They also agree there's a difference. Shapir kamri le Rabbanan Rabbi Meir. The rabbi has made a good claim to Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir, Meir dola liyotana mikar kedisha, hashtana mikedisha. Rabbi Meir says, wait a second, from a big city to a small city, originally it's holy and now it's also holy. Merabim le yachid, but from a public to an individual's ownership, leka kedusha, then there's no holiness. What does it mean there's no holiness? When you don't have the public present, you can't say words of holiness. You can't say Kaddish without a minion present. It's the public that gives it holiness. Once you've sold it to an individual, then you won't have any sayings of holiness in that building anymore. You guys are either asleep or out of it, or you're forgetting what we discussed when we started this chapter about holiness. But okay, if you're not bothered, I'm not bothered. V'rabbonon, i'ika lemeichash ki aigavna, ma'ika lemeichash. The rabbi said, if you're worried about that, you also have to worry about the idea of Berov HaMadrat Melech, that when you have a shul of the masses, then you have the masses present, and that's a fulfillment that's more glorious of Hashem. And just like you're not worried if you have the masses or you have only 10, by the same token, you're not worried from a public shul to an individual shul. What's the idea? You took money for the shul. That holiness has a place to go. That money will be used to buy a new shul. So, obviously, so I don't have to be worried about the fact that the shul went from being a public shul to an individual's house. Okay, there's a lot to discuss here. Should I tell you what should be bothering you?
Yeah, you just did.
When we started the chapter, we discussed why is something called holy. And we discussed the Brisker Rav that says in the Rambam that the idea of holiness revolves around Torah. Right? The Shmishe Kedusha, the Gemara we saw back on Chafav Amid Beis. The Shmishe Kedusha is anywhere you have Torah. And now, at least the way Rashi is learning, the idea of the holiness of the shul is not revolving around the Torah and the shul. It's revolving around the words of holiness, the Kaddish, the Kedusha, the words of holiness that are being said in the shul. That's a totally different concept of holiness than we were working with until now. So this needs work. Okay, and the Gemara tells us the logic of the rabbis, which is also a point that needs work. They say if you're worried about going from the masses to the individual, you should also be worried about the concept of Berovam Hadras Melech, that the more people present, the more glory there is to God. What's the connection? We don't know. The rabbis, for whatever reason, said they go hand in hand. If you're worried about one, worry about the other. Who said? You know, they are different concepts. So Rabbi Meir says the who said. But for whatever reason, the rabbi said they do go hand in hand. Mishnah. En mocherin betekneset el al tnai. You don't sell a shul, even if you're selling it from one public to another public. You can't sell it unless you have a condition, shem yotzu yachziru, that if you want, you could return, you could get back out of the sale, divrei Rabbi Meir. That's Rabbi Meir's opinion. B'chachamim amrim, mochin oto min karunam. The rabbis say, you could sell it, you could sell it to the individual, you could sell it a permanent sale. Chutz ma'abad dvarim, except for one of four things. There are four things that are unusually derogatory and you don't do them in a shul. What are they? Bathhouse, tannery, a place where people immerse, and a bathroom, or else a laundry room. One of the two. Rav Yehuda says, you sell it for the sake of being a yard, and he does whatever he wants with it. The idea is, Rav Yehuda says, it cannot be understood at the time of sale that he will make it into one of those four things. It has to be understood that he makes it into a yard. If after the sale he does something else, that's not your business. You already removed the holiness by the holiness went on the money. According to Rabbi Meir, if there's potential for the sale to be undone, so how could the guy live there? If you could undo the sale, so it's as though he's getting interest. One day you might walk in and say, we want to undo the sale. It turns out that all this time the money was on loan by us. Well, if the money's on loan by us, then how's he getting benefits from the shul? He's living there all this time. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yochanan says, Rabbi Meir b'shitat Rabbi Yehuda amara. Damar, tzad echad beribit mutar. Rabbi Yehuda is of the opinion that when you have a potential of something ending up being ribis, that's called tzad echad beribit. When we make a sale, and there's a condition, there's a stipulation, so there's potential that the sale will be undone, and then retroactively it turns out that the money was a loan by you, that's not called a loan. That's called tzad echad. There is one way in which the sale will be undone, and then turns out that all this time the money was on loan by you. Yeah? Now, if you're getting benefit during this time, let's take a simple case. There was a case here. A year ago, a guy wanted to buy a house. The seller had to get his paperwork together. It was an inheritance. And the buyer said, okay, I'll give you a down payment of 10%, but you got to give me the keys now because I'm ready to pay you the full amount. You just have to get your act together to give me the paperwork. As long as it takes you to get the paperwork together, I get to live in the house because I'm ready to pay the full price. So we'll put 10% in escrow. I get the keys to the house, and whenever you're ready, I give you the rest. Fine, so far, so good. What happens if after 3 months, he can't get his paperwork together? The courts say, well, we're not authorizing this sale, we're not authorizing this inheritance, we have to rework things out. So the guy who lived there for 4 months, or a year, or 10 years, now he got 10 years free rent. Based on what? Based on the potential that there would be a sale, based on the fact that he gave him the 10%, said hold on to these 10%. After a year or 10 years or as long as it happens, he's going to get his money back, right? and he got 1 year free rent. Happens to be I was the one who gave him the advice to go into this deal. And it just so turns out that it's a year now, and they haven't yet gotten their act together. So he got a year of free rent. He's not so happy because he wanted to buy the farm, and he wasn't looking for free rent. But at the end of the day, right now it looks like the whole deal might explode. If it explodes, he made 30,000 shekel off of this deal. He got free rent for a year, right? That's tzadechot beribis. It's a machlokas whether that's permissible or not. So I wasn't thinking about that when I told him. I don't know how luckily if that was good advice or bad advice. At the end of the day, he didn't live there. The lawyer wasn't willing to do this deal. But it would have been a good deal, right? So that's Rabbi Yehuda says that's permissible. Now, if Rabbi Meir says, when you sell a shul, there has to be a stipulation, but I could change my mind, you got to give me the money back, then how could you live there all these years? One of these days, you could take your money back, and he ends up having, he gave you a loan, then turns out that the whole sale was a loan, and then he got all these years of, it's like you were paying interest all this time for the loan of the money. So the Gemara says, Rabbi Meir goes with the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda that says, Sadecha beribis mutar detanya. Harei she'ano she'bechav romane v'asalo sadehu mecher. And the source for this halacha is as follows. Harei she'ano she'bechav romane. He claimed from his friend, he said, give me my 100 zuz that you owe me. V'asalo sadehu mecher. And he said, you know what? So, take my field. Bizman shemocher ochel perot mutar. He says, the Brisa says, who's eating the fruits? If it's the seller, so then that's permissible. Lokach ochel perot, if it's the buyer, asur, that's prohibited. Rabbi Yehuda omer, afilu lokach ochel perot mutar. Rabbi Yehuda says, even if the buyer is eating the fruits, that's permissible. Because what's he telling him? He's saying, you take care of the field. He tells him, if I don't give you the money, by the end of the year, the field is yours. Now, he tells him, I owe you $1 million. I own this building. If I don't pay you by the end of the year, the building's yours. What happens during that year? Who collects the rent? Or in this case, what happens during that year? Who collects the fruit? So, Tanakama says, well, what happens if he pays him back before the end of the year? So then it turns out he collected the rent, or he collected the fruit all year long, for the sake that he allowed him to wait that time in paying back the loan. That's interest. Rabbi Yehuda says, no, it's not interest, because he might not pay at the end of the year, and then the building is his. So that's called tzadechot beribis.
It only becomes his when he doesn't pay the money. Before that, it still belongs to him.
Very good. So all of that is discussed in Baba Basra. How does this work? But at any rate, Rabbi Yehuda is the one that says, tzadechot beribis. This is the classical case of tzadechot beribis. He owes money. He can't pay. He says, at the end of the year, the field is yours. Tanakama says, okay, the lender is not allowed to enjoy the fruits all year long because it's not yet his. Rabbi Yehuda says, yes, he can, because it just might not be his at the end. That's called tzadechot beribis. There's one angle in which it might end up being interest. It's not for sure interest. Amar Yehuda and Rabbi Yehuda quoted a case, Maseh Bebitzus Ben Zunin, that he did just that. He gave over the field, and Rabbi Elazar Ben Azariah approved it. And who got the fruits all year long? It was the purchaser. They told him, you're bringing us a proof from that story. You got the story wrong. In that story, the one who was having the fruits all year long was the seller, not the buyer, the borrower, not the lender. My benayu, what are they arguing about? Tzadechad beribitika benayu. The argument between them is what we just said, tzadechad beribit. When there's one way this could turn out being interest. Mal sevat tzadechad beribit mutar. Rabbi Yehuda holds that's permissible. Mal sevat tzadechad beribit asur. So we're saying Rabbi Meir goes in line with that opinion. That's what Rabbi Meir says. It's permissible to say when you sell a shul, I could change my mind in then. I'm allowed to take it back. Rava Amar, Rava gave a different answer. The Kuli Alma Tzadachat Berabit Asur. Really, everyone agrees? Not like Rabbi Yehuda. It's prohibited to make a deal like that. Behacha Rebit Amnat Lachzir Ika Benayu. Mal Savar Rebit Amnat Lachzir Mutar. Mal Savar Asur. The question here is, we're making a condition. If this doesn't work out, you'll pay me back the interest. So is it permissible? We're saying, if you have to give me back the shul, then you'll also have to pay me for all those years' rent. So then, right now, we're saying, I'm getting free rent. I'm living here for free. In the end, if we undo it, then I'll pay you back It's like a condition. I'll also pay you back for the time I was here. That's a machlokas, whether that's permitted or prohibited, and that's the machlokas in our Mishnah. Okay, so that's two possible understandings as to what the machlokas Rabbi Meir and Chacham is vis-a-vis ribbis, with the question of interest. Okay, so now...